The Two Comma Club was something started by a famous internet company called ClickFunnels. And ClickFunnels is like a software that helps people build online businesses. And ClickFunnels started this famous thing in the internet marketing world called the Two Comma Club. And the Two Comma Club is like this really exclusive thing that very few people get into. You know, it's kind of like the Mile High Club, but it refers to people who've made at least seven figures with their ClickFunnels website. Welcome to the Email Revolution. My name is Josh. Thank you for joining me and being a part of the show today. I've been looking forward to telling this story for a while. It's something that stuck with me for a long time, and this will be my first time sharing it. You never forget your first, they say. That's something I've heard, that you don't forget your first. And I think that's a true statement. I know for me, I'll never forget, because I fucked it up pretty bad, and so it stuck with me. There was a lot of buildup to it. I spent a lot of time thinking about it in my mind, you know, trying to picture how it would go, what I would say, how it would work. But I guess I still wasn't ready for it. You know, it came about kind of suddenly, a little bit out of nowhere. And I really wasn't ready for it. But then the next thing I knew, I was in it, you know, so it was sink or swim. And I was living at my brother's place at the time, actually. I was staying there. This was in the fall of 2018, after I had left my parents' house, moved out of the basement, and went down to crash at my brother's place. And he had this studio apartment in Tallahassee, Florida, where he went to school, FSU, Florida State University. And it was this little thing, a tiny studio apartment, just one room, up on the top floor of this big, massive building on College Avenue. It was a pretty big building, almost sort of looked like a hospital from the outside, you know, and not like a hospital where people go for like an emergency or anything, more like a big psychiatric hospital. Just a massive property, big rectangular wings. And if you've ever been out, you know, driving in the country and you pass by a state hospital, that's what they call them usually, a big old psych hospital. You know, I think nowadays they call them mental health units. Anyway, that's kind of what the building looked like if you were to pull up on it from the outside. So Ben lived in a studio apartment up there on the top floor, and that's where this happened, apartment 718. So he was there. He actually found the prospect. My brother did. Ben had found the prospect on Facebook, someone who responded to his post about emails, email sequences. And this guy was ready. He wanted to get on the phone. Dude wanted to talk to us right then and there. He was ready to do business. So we didn't really have much time to prepare. It was just happening right now. And the funny thing about it was I had been trying for months back home when I was living in the basement, and it never seemed to work for me. I had been trying to get leads, but for whatever reason, I couldn't seem to get anyone on the phone at the time. I had come close one time. I got close with that guy with the blind store, but then that guy turned out to be a no-show. Dude never made it to the call, and I never heard from him again. So then I got down to Tallahassee and I'm at my brother's place, and somehow, magically, Ben gets a lead. He finds a business owner on Facebook who's looking for help with email marketing. So that's how it got started. And I'll never forget how awkward it was that first time, man. It was awkward. Just the tone of the call, the pacing, it was all off. Everything seemed forced. It was awkward. And the guy's name was Jake Parker. He got us, this guy. He got us. We were thrown off pretty quick. Like, the call started off okay. I remember me and Ben were sitting next to each other on this little couch that he had in the apartment, and my laptop was open in front of us, and we were on a Zoom call with this man, this stranger that we didn't know. Didn't know each other existed until like 17 minutes ago. And we had our mentor, Mike Becker, had given us this discovery call document, it was called. So that was pulled up on the screen and we were going through it with this guy. It was like the script that you were supposed to follow on these calls, but it was a real, you know, it was a discovery because you were discovering all about the business, right? You were discovering about the prospect's company. So you were supposed to share it with them and go through it with them together on the phone. So that's what we were doing, you know, just like we had seen Mike Becker do with that lipstick company, Valor Cosmetics, way back when we watched his sales call recording, you know, his demo back when we were in Miami and we saw him, we witnessed him sell an email sequence for $5,000. And now here we were trying to do the same thing. Only I think at the time our goal was to sell an email sequence for like $500. We just needed to get our first gig. We weren't trying to overextend ourselves on this first one. We weren't going too hard at it. We just needed to land something, get our foot in the door. You know, we just wanted to get our first deal for email marketing. It wasn't going well. Once we got past the first part, it started to get tough. I think we did introductions, you know, and we introduced ourselves as brothers who happened to be email marketers. And I think we started asking Mr. Parker about his business and his website and stuff like that. It was a cool business. It was interesting. It was sort of an interesting company. The guy sold, let's see, how would I describe it? Like, you know, when you have a wedding and you've got a lot of people there, a lot of guests, and everyone's dancing and they're having a good time and everyone's all excited and partying. It's all fun and games. And then Aunt Polly has a little too much to drink, you know, so she starts making inappropriate remarks. You know, she starts saying some weird things to one of the younger dudes serving up the hors d'oeuvres, you know, starts calling him daddy or something like that. Just inappropriate because it's getting late. You know, that happens at weddings and stuff. You always have those couple of guests who just, they get a little too much liquor in them and they just let go a little, you know, a little more than they should. You know, they forget they're in public and they start just acting inappropriate. Like you'll see them commenting on people's jawlines and things like that. Anyway, everyone has those guests. When it gets late, you need something to keep them busy, something to keep them from wilding out too much with the busboys, you know. So that's when you can make your way over to Aunt Polly or Uncle Tyler, and you can just gently take that glass of champagne out of their hand and give them some Mardi Gras beads, right? And then you can walk them over to the corner of the room over on the side, and there's this big black box, and you just stuff them in there and forget about them for a while, right? Let them make their own fun. You know what I'm saying? Those things. Photo booths. Yeah. Photo booths. So like a photo booth you rent out for like a wedding or a graduation or whatever, something for the guests to do after they've had a few and it's getting late so that they can make some positive memories, you know, a little reminder of what they look like when they're, you know, when they're not on the antidepressants, something fun to put on the mantle or send to everyone in the Christmas card, you know. So that was Jake Parker's business, photo booths. But the thing is, Jake Parker wasn't like the guy who rented out the photo booths, right? He wasn't like the photo booth rental guy for the wedding. He was the guy who sold the photo booths to the guy who rented out the photo booths, okay? You know, he was like the guy upstairs. He was like the level above the photo booth rental company. I mean, he actually taught people how to build their own photo booth rental company, if that makes sense. So that was a pretty interesting company. And it seemed like a cool business. And he was telling us all about this business and about the photo booths and everything. And he'd be answering the questions from the discovery call document. And Ben was sitting next to me on the couch typing Jake's answers into the discovery document, into the Google Doc, so we could all see them, you know, because we were sharing the screen on the Zoom call. So it almost felt like the three of us were working together in like a collaboration at that point. But I think it was a little weird. Like when we had seen Mike Becker do the same thing earlier, it just, I don't know, it just seemed so smooth and like he was really in control of the whole situation. But when we were doing it, I didn't really feel in control as much. I felt a little uneasy, a little uncomfortable. And looking back on it, I wonder if Jake Parker could tell that. You know, looking back, I felt like he could probably tell we were new at it. I don't know. But we weren't super smooth or sharp. And I think at some point in the first, maybe after like the first 5 minutes of the call, it started to feel kind of awkward. And I think we all felt it. I think it was mutual. It was awkward for both parties on either side of the Zoom meeting. And it's hard to explain exactly why, but I think the moment it changed was when I asked him the revenue question, the dreaded revenue question. That's where it got weird. Because you see, there's this one part of the discovery call where you're supposed to ask the prospect how much money they make. You know, right after you find out about the business and how it works, you ask them how much money they make with the business. On the Google Doc, it said monthly revenue, and there's a blank space next to it where you're supposed to fill that in. And that's when, you know, that's when things can get a little dicey sometimes. It's kind of like a turning point in the call. It's almost like a test. It's like a test of trust almost. Does this complete stranger trust you enough after just meeting you a couple minutes ago? Do they trust you enough to tell you how much money they make? It's kind of a personal question, I guess. For some people, you know, it can be, because it's not something you normally go telling someone you just met. And I think some people are fine with it. In business, some people are used to answering that question, I think. So they don't always really have an issue answering it, but it also probably depends on who's asking. I feel like it can get dicey a lot of times when you get to that part of a sales call, especially when you're new at it and you don't have any experience asking that question, which I didn't at the time. And it's one of those things business owners, they can be uncomfortable with it sometimes because they think that you're asking because you're trying to size them up, you know? It's like asking someone what kind of car they drive, or like maybe when your buddy asks you how many girls you've slept with. You know, it's one of those questions that if you don't know the person real well who's asking, it can maybe make you uncomfortable. So I think when you're on a sales call with a business owner, sometimes it's like they think you're asking them how much money they make so that you can figure out how much to charge them. You know, like their answer is going to factor into your fee. Like, damn, this dude can afford to pay me 10 grand easily, you know? And especially if they sort of have an inkling that you're inexperienced, you know, like they can sometimes tell you haven't done this too many times, and that can be worse for them, I think. Like, it makes them even more uncomfortable. So anyway, things were going pretty chill at first. And then we got to that part in the discovery document where it says monthly revenue. So I, you know, nervously, I said, "So Jake, how much revenue are you making monthly?" And it was just silence. He said nothing. And I remember Ben and I looked at each other kind of like, is this guy going to answer? So I go, Jake, are you there? And he just goes, yeah, I'm here. Whew, that was a tough moment. So I said, oh, okay. I thought maybe it cut out for a second. And he just goes, nope, I heard you. So then I looked at Ben and we were both kind of stunned. You know, we looked like a couple of raccoons that just got rolled up on inside of an Arby's dumpster, you know, just like eyes wide as hell. Like we were caught, you know, at that point. So not knowing what to do, I awkwardly just repeated the question. That's what I did. I just said it again. Yeah, so how much revenue are you doing per month? And then immediately Jake goes, yeah, I'd rather not answer that. And that's when we had the most awkward silence. I think it was like the most awkward silence I've ever had in my life. But here's the thing. It was my first sales call ever. Very first time. So I wasn't prepared for this contingency yet. I didn't know, like, what are you supposed to do when they say that? You know, when I saw Mike Becker do the discovery call for him, the guy had just answered all the questions. So I thought that was how it was supposed to work. I had never seen this scenario, and I didn't know what you're supposed to do when they don't want to answer. So I looked at Ben, and he looked back at me and just shrugged his shoulders. So I just said, okay, you don't want to tell us how much you're making each month from your website? And he goes, no, I'm really not comfortable answering that. So I said, okay. And that was three times. So I knew I had struck out at that point. That was a strikeout. And in that moment, I just started clicking around the screen, you know, just clicking around to different questions on the doc. I don't even really remember what happened after that. You know, I think I started asking some of the other questions, and we might have even tried to sell the guy an email sequence, but the call had taken a bad turn at that point. So it was just, to be completely honest with you, that's all I really remember about my first time. That's all I remember about my first sales call. Because after that, it's all a blur. One of the things that, and I learned this later over the years, one of the things that really makes or breaks a sales call is trust. So once you've lost that, it's over. You may as well hang up the phone. It sucks. It's kind of depressing. It's one of those things you'd rather forget about, but you can't really. It stays with you. It stays with you over the years, and you'll never forget. But the thing about it, looking back, the silver lining of that story, if you will, is that was sort of the beginning of a new era for me. It's hard to explain, but things were about to change for us. And that was really the start of it. I had escaped my parents' basement. I had just moved out of there. If you've heard Emails from the Underground, then you know what that was like. I wasn't making any progress at all. I had just truly been stuck. And sometimes when you feel like you're really stuck and you don't have any options other than to force yourself out of it, and sometimes you have to physically change something. So what I had done, I got in my car one night and I just left. I drove from my parents' house in New Jersey down to Tallahassee, Florida, and I moved in there to my brother's apartment. You know, it was kind of fun on the one hand because it was almost like having a sleepover. You know, at first it was like, oh, this is cool, you know, like having a sleepover at my brother's place, like as if we're kids again, because that apartment was just one room. Everything was right there, kind of like it was all just, you know, you didn't need anything else. You had everything right there in front of you, couch, floor, TV. There was a whiteboard. My brother had his bed in one corner of the room, and then he had his desk over there, and there was a little kitchenette on the other side of the TV so you could do your cooking. There was a little bathroom. It felt like we were just kind of hanging out in that room, you know, eating in there, sleeping in there, working, watching TV. And it just felt like it could have been my mom's living room, you know, like we were just kids again. So I was happy just to be there at that time. You know, I think before, living in my parents' basement was just like, I felt so depending, you know, which was bothering me. I was depending on them. And I think that was just hard to deal with. So I think moving in with my brother, it just felt like a breath of fresh air. It's just so new at the time that I almost felt independent, even though I wasn't. Maybe it was a step towards independence, that first step. But really now I was just depending on him instead of my parents. I didn't just show up unannounced, you know, I called him on the way and I told him what had happened. Like I explained why I had left. I told him about the call I almost had, where the person never showed. And I told him about how I got kicked out of Rocky Blaze's Facebook group and about Mike Becker ripping me to pieces on open office hours and the fight with my parents. So he said, okay, just come down here for a little while. Just stay here for now until we get a client. And the thing is, I was broke at the time. You know, I didn't have much money. I had, you know, I had a little cash, you know, just enough to make it down there, really. But, you know, that was it. I didn't have enough money to get back. It was really sort of a one-way ticket, you know. So I was in a kind of a weird spot and feeling really defeated at the time. It was like nothing was going right for me, it felt like. And it seemed like no matter what I did, everything was against me. Like just nothing was working. And I think Ben heard that. Like he could kind of hear it in my voice. And so I guess he must have felt like the best thing for me would probably just be a change of environment, you know, like a change of pace. And I think he knew it was a risk too, inviting me to come down there. He probably had his doubts about it at the time. But he maybe also felt like he didn't have much of a choice. You know, he was there trying to finish his final year of college. And I'm sure it was challenging for him to take me in until I got back on my feet. Because it wasn't like he had an income either. You know, he was in school. So he was just living off student loans. He had student loan money, which was just supposed to be for him to live. You know, it wasn't meant to support two people. But I think that the hope for us at the time was just that we were like a minute away from getting our first email marketing client, our first copywriting client, and then I'd have plenty of money again. I think we thought that we were only like 1 minute away from that happening. We weren't thinking about me living there as some sort of long-term thing. It was supposed to be a really short-term solution. Having both of us there in Tallahassee wasn't really an ideal situation, I don't think. And not just because of the obvious, you know, living in that studio apartment together that's really just supposed to be for one person, but also just because Tallahassee isn't really an ideal environment when you're trying to build a business or really anything. It's not an ideal place for getting stuff done. If you've never been to Tallahassee, it's always a bit of a shock when you roll in there for the first time. It feels like you went into a portal and came out somewhere. Like, what's that movie where they fall into the mirror and they come out in some fantasy world? That's kind of what it's like if you've never been. Tallahassee is sort of like a portal to another dimension of humanity. It doesn't function the same way as a lot of like how ordinary towns or cities do. In Tallahassee, people go to just live outside the boundaries of a normal civilized society. It's a little hard to describe the environment there. The best way I can really describe it is it'd be like if every 14-year-old in the state stole their parents' car keys and then they all just went in one direction and just ended up in Tallahassee. You know, like they're all joyriding around in the circle at the exact same time. That's Tallahassee. You've got the Florida State Capitol with the Capitol building and the governor's mansion and all the courts. And then right on top of it is Florida State University. And then surrounding that is just chaos, almost like this sort of, almost like this sort of underbelly element, I guess. And it's not even really spread out at all. Everything's kind of right on top of each other. Like the college is right in the middle of the government area and the politicians are right in there with all the college kids and then all the rest of the sort of, you know, the other people who've been sort of rejected by society, you know, people who just kind of fell through the mirror are just thrown on top of it all, just walking around and everyone looks a little dazed. I think everyone's just trying to figure out who's really running things. You know, is it the college kids? You know, is it the politicians or is it the vagrants? You know, everyone's just trying to figure out who's in charge. Lots of people doing all kinds of things they can't get away with in other places. And everyone's got like a combination of things going on in them, I feel like. Like, I feel like if you ran up to someone random on the street and you hit them on the back, a couple of Xanax and a can of Red Bull would come flying out, you know? The whole place just has that. Everyone's got a weird combination of things running through their system. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But you can really see it when you're driving around down there. Because when you drive around Tallahassee, bro, you got to drive carefully. And I thought I knew defensive driving from my time driving for Uber down in Miami, but I didn't. I didn't really learn defensive driving until I got to Tallahassee. Because you got to learn to stop at all the green lights down there. Like, in Miami, people don't always obey the traffic laws, but in Tallahassee, there are no traffic laws. You know, they don't even follow the designated roads. People just drive on whatever side of the road they feel like, man. the lanes are just optional. You know, sometimes you'll just see people driving on the median. People don't follow the red lights over there. And the cars are a little scary too. You know, like 3 out of every 5 of them is a 1963 Chevy Impala with like 64 inch rims. They're real low down to the ground, but you can't even see over the top of those things. And then you got a lot of tan Pontiacs with the back window missing, you know, like the back window is just duct tape, no glass. Someone just taped that bitch up. And it's scary driving around with all these things flying around, zipping by, running red lights. Just everything's just going nuts, you know, just going a little nuts. Like you fell asleep and woke up inside a damn Hot Wheels playset, you know, some 5-year-old's controlling all the cars, running them around the track. And he drank one too many Capri Suns, you know, and you're just in there with no way out. That's Tallahassee. There's no rules. It's a different world over there. I remember the Chick-fil-A there used to stay open till 4 a.m. 4 a.m. Never heard of that anywhere. Every single night, even on Sundays, which is wild because Chick-fil-A isn't even supposed to be open on Sundays. Never seen that anywhere else in my life. Chick-fil-A open all night long, but that's how it was. And I remember sometimes we'd go over there at 2 in the morning on like a Wednesday, and the drive-through line would be packed. Just they had this huge drive-through area, and it was always completely filled no matter what time. And the thing about going through a drive-through in Tallahassee is you have to keep your windows rolled up the whole time. The whole time. You really can't even roll down your window when you go to give them your order. Because at all the drive-throughs in Tallahassee, you'd have crackheads jumping out of the bushes, scaring people half to death. And that's not even a joke. All the homeless in the area would have their own territories. And the fast food establishments along the main road, those were the top spots. So like I remember there was this one dude, Wilson, and he controlled the Taco Bell drive-through. Old scraggly looking fellow with a baseball cap and a beat up Marlins jersey. He would roam the line. And I remember his thing was to try to get you at the actual drive through window. That was kind of his deal. So while they're handing you your food, so you'd have to be like really fast when you would pull up to that window because Wilson would be right there waiting for you. And it was scary. Like you wouldn't even see him sometimes till you're right up there, which was terrifying. You know, like you're sitting there, everything's fine. You're about to get your cheesy gordita crunch. And then suddenly you'd watch the car in front of you would get their food handed to them and they'd just peel off to the right all fast. And then in their place, you'd just see Wilson standing there, you know, looking at you, licking his palms, you know, because he sees you rolling up. But yeah, man, the Chick-fil-A drive-through belonged to a woman named Linda. That was a scary place late at night because Linda was really aggressive. She was the most aggressive out of all of them. And you never saw her coming either. That was the thing. She'd sneak up on you while you were waiting to order. That was her strategy. And it would scare the shit out of you. I remember she used to come right out of the bushes. There'd be like one car in front of you and they're placing an order. And you'd be on deck next up to bat. And suddenly, just as you're getting ready to pull up, Linda would come walking out of the bushes and she'd be like wearing a dark coat and she'd have sunglasses on, even though it was dark outside. So you wouldn't see her right away, but she'd step right out of the bushes to your left. So she'd be right next to you and she'd walk right up lightning speed to your window and she'd go and you'd basically shit yourself. It was one of the scariest things I've ever experienced, but that was Linda. Hey, $5. Please and thank you. $5. That shit was aggressive as fuck. I bet she made a good living, honestly. Because folks probably just gave her all their money on instinct, you know. But yeah, that was Tallahassee, man. Real, real interesting place. Real fun. Different experience. So the next day after my disastrous first sales call, I actually got on an open office hours with Mike Becker. Mike Becker. And the thing about Mike Becker, you know, he's always ready to get angry at something, especially back in those days, because he was coaching copywriters on how to get clients. And he was just always, he'd always be getting frustrated when it wasn't working out for them, you know, And Mike's a good coach. He really cared. That's the thing about Mike. So, you know, if you didn't have good news for him, you had to be a little nervous. I hadn't even been back to an open office hour since that time when he forced me to play the phone game with Nancy, and he'd ripped into me pretty hard that day. He had basically told me not to come back till I had gotten some real sales experience with a real sales call. So now I had gotten one, so it was time to go back. And I remember being nervous, but I was anxious to hear what Mike was going to say, because now I had actually gotten a prospect on the phone and had followed the template he laid out for us, and it didn't work. So I wanted to know what went wrong. So I went back to open office hours, and that's where Mike Becker did what Mike Becker does best. He made me feel like a fucking idiot, which is, you know, probably what I needed. When Mike Becker called on me that day in open office hours, he asked me to catch him up on what's happened since the last time. So I said something like, "Well, Mike, I finally had my first sales call." And I think at first he sounded happy for me, you know, and he said, "Okay, good. You had your first sales call. Cool. What happened? Did you close a deal?" And that's when I started shifting around nervously at that point, sitting on Ben's couch, same exact couch where I had fucked up the call the day before. And I tried to explain, you know, I tried my best to explain what had happened. I said, "So we followed the discovery call template just like you said to do. We pulled it up on the screen and we went through it with the prospect, but he didn't really want what we were trying to sell him." And then Mike snapped back at me, "Josh, what do you mean he didn't want what you were trying to sell him? What were you trying to sell him?" "We were trying to sell him an email sequence," I answered. So then Mike said, "Okay, hang on. Let's back up a second here. Where did you find this guy? Where did this prospect come from?" Now, the interesting thing is, we had actually found this prospect on something called the Cult of Copy Job Board. The Cult of Copy Job Board. And the Cult of Copy, it wasn't like an actual cult. And job board is sort of, I guess it's not a bad way to describe it, I guess. It's this Facebook group where business owners hang out sometimes and they'll make a post when they need a copywriter for a project or something. And copywriters go in there and they make posts to kind of offer themselves up for work. It's kind of like a Craigslist for internet marketing, basically. Like, you'll have people posting in there and being like, "Hey, I'm a copywriter from Bulgaria and I'll write you a Google ad for $100. And then you'll have people posting jobs like, "Hey, I'm looking for someone to write a sales page to help me sell this health supplement that increases the volume of breast milk in cats who are breastfeeding, you know, looking for a copywriter with experience in the feline health arena." And so then you'd have all these copywriters commenting on the post asking for the job. So the theory is you can find a good match on there. You know, you can get yourself a client from the Cult of Copy Job Board. So Ben had made a post in there offering to write email sequences, and that's how we had gotten in touch with this Jake Parker fella. So I explained all that to Mike. And then Mike said, "Okay, so you guys made a post on Cult of Copy Job Board offering email sequences, and this guy saw your post, and then he got on the phone, and now you're telling me that he didn't want email sequences. That doesn't make any sense, right?" So I said, "Well, I mean, yeah, he did get on the phone because he wanted email sequences, but then as the call went along, it just didn't seem like he, and that's when Mike started getting a little agitated, I think, and he said, "Josh, this guy literally got on the phone to buy emails from you because he saw your post on Cult of Copy Job Board offering to write emails. He wouldn't have gotten on the phone if he wasn't interested in what you were selling. He was interested. You just didn't close the deal for whatever reason. You just did a shitty job on the call. Does that make sense?" And at that point, it was kind of like, I almost felt like I was in a battle with Mike a little. You know, I started trying to defend myself. So I said, Yeah, Mike, I know he was interested, but I don't know what happened. He didn't want to answer the questions on the discovery call document. And when I said that, there was a pause for a second. And then I heard Mike sigh. Okay. I'm not trying to be a dick right now, Josh, but it sounds like you fucked up. You're telling me he was interested, but he wasn't willing to answer your questions on the call. So my first thought is he probably wasn't a qualified prospect. Are you sure this guy was qualified in the first place? Yes, I said without hesitation. So then Mike said, okay, tell me more about this prospect, Josh. What kind of business does he have? So I said, a photo booth business, and I started to explain what it was, but Mike cut me off. What do you mean a photo booth business? What is that? So I continued. I said, well, this guy actually teaches people how to create their own photo booth rental companies, like to rent out photo booths for weddings and stuff. He supplies the booths and he teaches them how to build the business. And Mike actually sounded interested at that point. Like he kind of perked up a little and he said, okay, so like a turnkey business solution, a business in a box or a business in a booth, I guess. That's interesting. And then he asked me the big question. Josh, so how much revenue is this guy doing per month? And now that's when I perked up because this was kind of what I had been waiting for. You know, this was what I was waiting to get to because I wanted to know how Mike would have handled this fella not answering the revenue question. That's the thing, Mike, I said, and I could kind of feel my confidence building a little as I talked. I don't know how much revenue because he wouldn't tell me. And then there was a little silence again, briefly, before Mike said, what do you mean he wouldn't tell you? He wouldn't tell me. It was crazy, Mike. The call was actually going really great until I got to the revenue question. That's when everything changed. He said he didn't want to tell me how much money he was making, and that's when the whole call kind of changed from there. Then Mike said, so when you asked him how much revenue he was making, what happened? He just didn't say anything? Yeah. He said he wasn't comfortable sharing. Then Mike sighed again. Okay. Josh, that means he probably wasn't qualified. That's what I'm getting from this. What's his website? So at that point, I was eager for Mike to check this out because I was pretty sure the guy was qualified. So I wanted to see what he was going to say. So I told him the website and he immediately pulled it up on his screen and started clicking around on everything like he loved to do. And he read aloud from the homepage. Join the thousands of other moms, dads, and everyday folks who have quit their 9-to-5 and started making six figures a year by renting out photo booths for weddings, bat mitzvahs, and graduation parties. Then he scrolled down to the About section and found a picture of Jake Parker. Who is this guy? Jake Parker is this dude's name? And before I could say anything else, Mike already had Facebook pulled up and he was typing in Jake Parker. Okay, let's see. 487 mutual friends. Let's see who this guy is. And right then, Mike pulls up Jake Parker's Facebook profile. And you could tell right away that he was a real business owner. He just looked like a successful guy. In one picture, he was wearing like a blue blazer and a bow tie, standing next to this big house, really big house. Looked like a nice property, manicured lawn and everything. And in another picture, he was standing in front of a pair of exotic cars in his own garage. Looked like a Porsche and a Lamborghini. So, you know, right away, you could tell this guy was legit. But the most interesting thing was his cover photo. You know how on Facebook you have a cover photo that goes above everything at the top of your page? Well, in Jake's cover photo, it looked like he was holding up two big framed records, like these big golden records in a frame. Like maybe this dude had gone double platinum, you know? I wasn't sure if maybe he had like a record label. It kind of looked like maybe that's what was going on there. But Mike immediately stops and says, okay, so this guy is Two Comma Club, double Two Comma Club. Now, Two Comma Club was a term you'd only know if you were in the digital marketing world. It's a very niche term, internet marketing lingo. But I'd be lying to you if I said I didn't know what it meant at the time. I knew what it meant. The Two Comma Club was something started by a famous internet company called ClickFunnels. And ClickFunnels is like a software that helps people build online businesses. And ClickFunnels started this famous thing in the internet marketing world called the Two Comma Club. And the Two Comma Club is like this really exclusive thing that very few people get into. You know, it's kind of like the Mile High Club, but it refers to people who've made at least seven figures with their ClickFunnels website. So if you have a Two Comma Club award, that means you made two commas, you know, because seven figures or $1 million has two commas in it. So Two Comma Club means you made two commas. So now you're in the exclusive club. They actually reward you when you officially make it there by sending you this golden record thing that says your name and it says your business and it says the year and it says Two Comma Club to make it official that you're a millionaire, you know. And out of all the online businesses in the world, probably less than 0.5% of them ever make it to the Two Comma Club. So there's very few people who have a Two Comma Club award, you know. But here was this dude, Jake Parker, and there he is holding up two of those bad boys in his cover photo, which basically meant that his online business made $1 million at least twice. So yeah, once Mike Becker saw that picture, his whole demeanor sort of, really, he just became even more irritated, you know, even more frustrated than before, which was kind of frightening, to be honest. And I remember I felt nervous again when Mike started talking because I could tell he really wasn't happy with me. And he said, Josh, buddy, Jake Parker is double Two Comma Club. You can literally see it right here on his profile. And I didn't really have anything to say to that. So I just said, right. And then there was an awkward silence. And I think Mike sort of, his mind was blown. Like he couldn't believe I wasn't on the same page as him. And then when he finally spoke again, Josh, why did you ask this guy the revenue question? At that point, I'll admit I was confused. Like, what did he mean? Why did I ask the revenue question? I thought I was supposed to ask the revenue question. So I sort of stumbled a little and I said, Mike, I thought I was supposed to. Aren't I supposed to ask everyone the revenue question? And I mean, how could that be wrong? You know, that question was on the discovery call document. It was a part of the sales script. Why would he not want me to ask it? I didn't get it. So then Mike said, okay, Josh, here's the thing. We ask the revenue question to make sure a client is qualified, right? Does that make sense? So I said, Yeah, I guess so, but I thought we're always supposed to ask, Josh, listen, bud, if someone is making 30K a month with their business and they're paying for traffic to their website, that's a qualified prospect. We know this. So we ask the revenue question to make sure that they're qualified. So if you already know this guy is a qualified prospect, then what's the point of asking that question, right? It's kind of stupid to ask at that point, right? And to be honest, it sort of made sense what he was saying, but I wasn't sure. I was still kind of almost still defending myself at that point, you know, because I still felt kind of justified almost. Like to me, it made perfect sense to ask the revenue question at the time. And I was still a little put off by the fact that that dude hadn't answered it. Like, why not answer it? You know, why not answer how much money your business makes? To me, like, I don't know. I felt like if it were me, I would have still answered. I would have been proud of it, you know? So to Mike's question, I said, I don't know. And I think Mike was really trying to get me to understand. Josh, look at it this way, okay? You're asking this guy how much money he makes. And all you had to do was look at his Facebook page. And he's literally holding up two Comma Club awards right there in his cover photo. So he's literally giving you the answer right there. He's saving you the time of asking him the revenue question. He's telling you right there how much money he makes. This guy is a qualified prospect for sure. He makes millions of dollars. And you're over here asking him how much money he makes. He was probably insulted at the question, honestly. And I remember I just sat there, blinking, sort of in a daze, as I started to realize how badly I had fucked up. So I said, yeah, I guess you're right. And then Mike said, okay, so you fucked up the call, bro. Sorry to say it, but the guy is literally holding double two Comma Club awards, and then you asked him how much money he makes. So it really doesn't matter what happened at that point after that, because you had already fucked up. Does that make sense? And I felt terrible. It was like my worst fears had been realized. This guy could have been our first client, but I ruined it. So I just sat there in silence. My head was in my hands and my eyes were closed. And Ben was over on the other side of the room at his desk at that point, half listening, you know, doing homework or something on his laptop. So I just sat there and didn't say anything for a minute, feeling defeated. Josh, Mike said, are you there, buddy? Yeah, I'm here, Mike, I said reluctantly. I hear you, man. I fucked up. Josh, the discovery call is a template. And it's your job to customize that template. I can't do that for you. You have to customize it for yourself. And yeah, that's all there is to it, really. I don't have anything else to say about that. What other calls have you been on? And when he asked that, it kind of jolted me. Because that Jake Parker call was the only call I had ever done at that point. So I said, no, yeah, that was my first call. I didn't have any others. And then Mike said, you need to get on a lot more sales calls, bud. That's your problem. The answer is you need more volume. Who the fuck cares about fucking up one sales call when you have five calls a day, 6 days a week? Does that make sense? One is, okay, cool. You had one call. When's the next one scheduled for? I don't have any more calls scheduled right now, Mike. Why not? I don't know. I didn't know. So Mike said, what are you doing to get more sales calls? Your calendar should be full with calls Monday through Friday. You should even be taking calls on Saturday. You need a business right now. You don't even have a business. What are you doing every day to generate new business? Because so far, it sounds like you're not doing much. We've got posting in Facebook groups. Cool. What else? And Mike had me there. I really wasn't doing anything else. But to be honest, I didn't really know what else to do. Mike had taught me to prospect in Facebook groups. What else was there? And that's when Mike Becker told me something I'll never forget. He said, Josh, you want to own a business, right? Well, as a business owner, you need to step up here and start acting like a real business owner. You need to start coming up with answers yourself. You can't just expect other people to give you all the answers. That's something that's important. And I think a lot of people get lost because they do expect other people to give them the answers. And at the time, that's how I was. But then Mike did something that was kind of unexpected. He decided to give me the answers. And right then and there, he told me three ways to get clients that I had never thought of. The first thing he said I should do was he said to write email samples or sample emails for companies who I wanted to work with and then send them over to him. You know, because sometimes you'll see a company and think, damn, that could be a cool company to work with. Or, you know, that would be really cool if I had them as a client. So Mike told me to write emails for those companies and send them over. Just write a couple emails and tell them to send them out to their email list. And he said, then when they run your emails to their list and your emails make them all this money, all you have to do is say, okay, would you like for me to get even more of these results for you? And then they're going to say yes, and then you have a client. Does that make sense? And then the second thing Mike told me to do was to make a Facebook post offering to give people email templates. He said, you're going to make a post on your personal Facebook timeline, and you're going to say, hey, I have a template of a 4-part cart abandonment sequence that will increase your store revenue by 15 to 30%. Who wants it? Comment yes on this post and I'll shoot it over to you. And he said what I should do is take one of the email templates out of the vault and send it over to those new leads in a private message. And at first when he said that, I was confused. So I said, Mike, you want me to just share your templates with people? And that's when he said, bro, those templates, first off, Those templates aren't some breakthrough cure for cancer that no one's ever heard of shit. Josh, I've been repurposing the same shit for the past 10 years. I'm not saying go spreading them to everyone around the internet. I'm saying offer them to potentially qualified leads in order to get them on the phone and sell them email marketing. Does that make sense? So I asked him, but Mike, how do I get them to work with me by giving them the template? Wouldn't that defeat the purpose of them needing me to write emails for them? So he said, no, you give them the template. Then a couple days later, you reach back out to them and you say, hey, how's that template working for you? And most of the time, they're not going to get very far because they aren't copywriters. So they're going to take one look at it and probably be like, this is too hard. Or else they're going to try to use it, but they're going to get stuck at some point and they're going to want help. So that's when you can say, hey, would you like me to customize that template for you? And then they say yes, and bam, you've got a client. That's the thing about Mike. I can't really do him justice by telling you this story, but he always has this way of coming up with a lot of really good ideas on the spot that you never thought of and making you feel like an idiot for not thinking of them yourself. And then he said, make a post like that and I can pretty much guarantee that you'll have 30 plus people raising their hands and asking you for the template. And those are your new leads. It's really fucking simple. Then he gave me one more idea that at the time I thought was the best idea of all. He said, Josh, you got kicked out of Rocky Blaze's Facebook group, right? So I said, yeah. And then he said, do you know why you got kicked out? So I said, well, I was just making value posts in there to try to get clients like you said to do. But apparently they said I broke one of the rules because you're not supposed to. And Mike cut me off and said, no, that's not why. You know why you got kicked out? Because Facebook groups suck. They don't want you prospecting their members. Does that make sense? And then he said, okay, fine. So how about you go ahead and create your own Facebook group? That way you'll be the authority because you're the guy who owns the group, right? And when you have your own Facebook group, you can prospect all you want in there and no one can say shit to you because it's your own Facebook group. Does that make sense? Man, I'll never forget those open office hours calls because they really were the thing that got our business off the ground in the sense that it got us thinking like business owners and it got us moving and taking action. It was like Mike had just rolled back the curtain and revealed a whole new world for me. And here I was limiting myself, thinking that this was so hard. You know, thinking that all I could do was go in Facebook groups every day and make value posts and message people. But in that moment, it kind of seemed like there was just an infinite number of ways to get clients. And I didn't know why I had been thinking so scarce-minded before, because these were all simple things that I could do right away. And I'd always say thank you to Mike a lot, because he really set us straight in those early days. And I felt like he never really got the credit from a lot of people. You know, to this day, there's a lot of really successful people and a lot of businesses that wouldn't even exist without Mike Becker. So I used to really, you know, make sure I was thanking him a lot and letting him know that we really appreciated all the help and the advice he was giving us. And he'd always respond by saying something like, yeah, don't mention it. That's why I'm here. This stuff isn't hard. It's not brain surgery. This is just the work, right? But I'll be honest. Right after that call, I looked at Ben and we both felt a little overwhelmed. We knew it was time to take action on what Mike had said to do, which felt good, but at the same time, it felt like we were staring up at a mountain that we were about to start climbing. Because, you know, looking back on it, that was really the moment where I think we actually became committed to building a brand new business. It's not like we weren't in business before that, and it's not like we had given up or anything. But up until that point, I think so much had happened and so many things just didn't work out. But we didn't really have a real business. We were just sort of trying stuff, you know? But it was always like this feeling of, damn, like, okay, that didn't work. What's the next thing to try? And then you learn the next thing and you try that, you know, maybe this time it'll work. And then, okay, maybe that, you know, maybe that didn't work. What now? You know? But I think that after that point, it was like a perspective shift. It felt like our perception had changed because before that, was this sort of feeling of, okay, I suck at this. You know, I failed. That was a failure. The body language product only made one sale. Failure. You know, running out of money. Failure. Moving back home. Failure. That guy didn't show up on the sales call. Failure. You know, I got kicked out of the Facebook group. Failure. Fucked up the call with Jake Parker. Was that a failure, you know, or was it really just the next thing that needed to happen in the business, right? And I think that's where Mike changed our perception on that open office hours call, because he told me I fucked up, but then he made me realize how many other ways I could get clients that I wasn't even thinking of, you know? So it was almost like I was realizing there's so many ways to succeed. It's like you can never run out of ways. You know, that's what's crazy, is I was focused on all the different ways I was failing. And the reality is there's always more ways. You know, you can always fail more. But it's like if you understand that it doesn't matter, because it's just the next thing. Whether it succeeds or fails, it almost doesn't matter. I don't know if that even makes sense, but looking back, I can tell you something changed from that point forward, and it was like we were living in new times. And it was really the beginning of building a brand new business, I feel like. And one thing that's interesting is eventually as we started building it, we had this realization that something was missing. What happened was we started to realize that we were easily looked over, or not so much looked over, but more like we were easily getting lost in the noise. Because what started to happen was we saw how many people were also trying to do the same thing as us at the same time. The marketplace on Facebook where we were, it was starting to feel crowded, you know? Like, for example, you go on Cult of Copy job board and it was like every damn, you know, every foreign exchange student in the world is up in there trying to earn a little extra side money writing copy for businesses, you know? Like every Tom, Dick, and Harry is on there trying to buy his girlfriend a new chinchilla, you know, by writing email sequences for companies. Or you go into a Facebook group and it's just filled with people making value posts, trying to get attention. And it's like we started feeling like it was a struggle to stand out from the crowd. You know, like our posts just seemed too similar to other people's. And we were afraid of getting lost in the noise. So we felt like we needed a way to distinguish ourselves, a way to separate ourselves. And the other thing was, we noticed that most of these were all individuals. You know, the copywriters were all freelancers for the most part. It was always one guy or one girl, but it felt like we were sort of different because here we were still trying to do this as a group of guys. You know, there were three of us, me, Ben, and Dom, tres amigos. So at first it was like, you know, is that weird? Right? Because we didn't see that as much, like groups of people doing this. But then I started noticing something else. As I was going around on Facebook in these different groups and things, I started to notice some people, some businesses who were referring to themselves as agencies, the Pink Whale Agency or the Giggling Goblin Agency or whatever. All these agencies, all these people doing agencies. And they all started popping up on my Facebook newsfeed all the time because they were out there. You know, they were putting themselves out there just like I was, just trying to provide services to online businesses. But then when I looked closer to see what it was that they were offering, you know, what kind of services do these people do? It was like they were all offering the same stuff. You know, that they were all doing Facebook ads and social media mostly. And I think that was something kind of interesting is that for some companies, you know, some of the more established businesses and brands, they really liked putting trust into an agency rather than just like hiring one person to do something freelance. But what I started to realize was that none of these self-identified agencies were offering email marketing services that I could see at the time. It was all this other stuff. You know, you saw some SEO agencies and things like that, but mostly social media ad agencies was the bulk of it. And up until that point, you know, we didn't really think of ourselves as an agency. We hadn't thought of that. We were just a couple of guys. We were just a business or a company. An agency sounded like something bigger, I guess. But then as I started doing more research and taking a bit of a closer look at some of these agencies, I realized a lot of them were small. A lot of them only had a couple people. So that's when I thought, wait, what if we called ourselves an agency? Like, seeing how, on the one hand, all these people offering copywriting services were mostly individuals. And then on the other hand, all the agencies were doing other stuff. So maybe that's actually the thing that makes us different. You know, maybe that could distinguish us from the crowd and give us an identity. We could be an agency that does the thing that usually agencies don't do, you know? So I could not find any other agencies offering copywriting, and more specifically, email marketing. But here we were. So what if we were the email agency? And then I thought, what if that was our name? What if we just called ourselves the email agency? And as it turned out, I Googled the email agency and nothing came up. I couldn't find any other business called the email agency, which I thought was odd, you know, because it didn't even seem that original at first. So then I went on GoDaddy.com to see if anyone owned that name for a website. And I looked it up and I couldn't believe it. No one had it. The emailagency.com was an available domain. It was like it was waiting there for us. Suddenly we had an identity. So that's how the email agency was born.